Hello, everyone. Apparently Julian is supposed to be joining us. Hopefully he's having some computer problems, but if he doesn't, it's just me and Sarah for today. Fortunately or
It can't access my
unfortunately,
video, but I think it can. Can you see me?
I could see you.
All right. No, I don't know.
So get with it, Riverside. How are things going on your end, Sarah?
They are great. Never been better.
Really? Never really.
Well, my entire outlook on life is just entirely dictated by how the Philadelphia sports teams I care about are doing. So the
Got it.
Eagles won, and it was a rough win. They looked like they were losing, but they won, and I'm happy this week until Thursday when they play again Thursday night.
Which
Let's see.
may completely change your look on everything. I actually had that as one of the topics that I had here. So Julian said that
Football.
he may not be able to join. I told him to just join by phone, like who cares? But you are such a huge sports fan, and like anybody that follows you on Twitter can obviously realize that. Like, how do you juggle that with like having kids and also you're married and you run, you're a CEO of a company? How do you juggle all that stuff?
All right. So first of all, I'm not just any sports. It has to be a Philadelphia sports team.
Sure. Right.
But it is literally a full-time job, especially when we have baseball season still going on and the Phillies are making a run for the playoffs and then football's starting. So there's
Yeah.
that. So it's a commitment.
But how do you do it? Honestly, like I just like for my mind. So like I'll give you my perspective. So like I'm Canadian. I'm a big hot well, I used to be a big hockey fan. I had season tickets to the Vancouver Canucks. I'm from Vancouver, huge fan when I was there. Then moved out here. Didn't have anybody else to watch games with. It kind of deteriorated, and like now I'll watch the games every now and then. I can't get Canucks games a lot, like even on TV, which is like sad. NFL obviously is a little different, but I would say that my ability to even follow like my like passion, I also like play hockey, love hockey. But like it's also with having a family and running a startup, like you're one of the most vocal people on Twitter on sports, I would say, in the entrepreneurship like startups side. How do you like
So a couple
do
things.
all of
First of
those
all,
things?
it's really it's nice not living in Philadelphia because I can't really get to games. So I go to very few games, or I see the Warriors, the
Right.
Niners, or the Giants out here, which is every once in a while. So the fact that I can't actually easily attend games means the time commitment is not a big commitment, though I do, went to
It
the
takes up a lot of mental brain space. It's
yeah.
going like right now you're happy because
Yes,
you had a
the
good
emotional
weekend.
commitment. So
Yeah.
I watch, every football game when I can, but I don't watch every baseball game because there's way too many baseball games. But I follow the teams and I check the scores, but that's just kind of my downtime. Some people watch TV shows. I watch sport.
That's fair.
I also combine it. We
That's
do
fair.
a lot of inviting people over to watch games. So it's kind of my social life too. And try to, have families over that have
That's great.
kids,
That makes sense.
that are friends with my kids so that the kids can all play and entertain each other while we watch football or basketball or baseball. So it's kind of also a social thing for me.
Right, but also, so w would you consider that like your third full-time job then, I guess? Or
My
fourth?
goal in life is to own a professional sports team.
Wow.
No.
That's awesome.
I can start, smaller with it doesn't have to be a NFL team,
Yeah.
maybe like a women's basketball team or women's
Yeah,
soccer team
yeah,
or something, but eventually, got to work my way up. But that keeps me motivated is, how do I become a multi-billionaire so I can go buy a professional sports team?
that's really cool. that kind of brings me to another topic. I was trying to find the tweet, but I remember seeing this. I think that I shared this in some, or I'm in so many different group chats, that the most successful, I think this is from an angel investor after they analyzed like 200 plus angel investments, that it actually turns out that the most successful companies are actually driven by the founders that have financial outcomes in mind versus the ones, I don't know if you know the tweet that I'm talking about, versus the ones that are driven by fame or like a purpose or something like that.
Yeah.
Does that resonate with you? It definitely resonated with me.
I was on a podcast once that was specifically about the childcare industry, and they didn't publish my podcast episode. And they gave me feedback that I was, you know, talking about too much about like how much the industry is worth and how much money, you know, these could make in the industry. And they didn't like that because they felt like childcare should be a public good. And yes, there should be more government funding for childcare. I'm never going to be against that. I would love that. But it's also, there's a lot of money to be made in this industry. And I feel like if we don't share that and share what a large market it is, we won't attract great entrepreneurs to innovate in childcare. So I have no shame in saying, I think a lot of money can be made in childcare. I think it actually is a large, it keeps the economy running. It's a large portion of the GDP. So we absolutely should talk about, you know, how rich entrepreneurs and investors in childcare and parenting can get. I mean, parents are the largest consumer segment. They control all the dollars. I don't have any shame and you know, that podcast wouldn't publish it, but I will continue to speak my mind and say, yes, there can be huge financial outcomes here, and we shouldn't just pretend that it can only be a charity, because that undervalues the industry and the work that people are doing in childcare.
Do you think that there is some shame in saying that, like, what you just said, right? Like, your ultimate goal is to own a professional sports team, which means that you at least need to be a 100 millionaire, if not a billionaire. Do you think that there's
not a women's WNBA team, still quite affordable?
Sure, right, but it all obviously requires capital, right? And do you think that there's like shame, like saying that to either your employees or publicly, or even investors? I find that there's this narrative of, like, I don't know, I kind of go back to like The Social Network, the movie, and it was like, we want to connect as many people in the world, and it's all about this mission driven piece. And like, besides saying like, I want to like make as much fucking money as I possibly can for myself so I can do is there shame in that, do you think?
I think for me, I work in such a mission impact driven industry that no one debates the fact that I care about the impact that my company is having and the mission of, you know, making childcare accessible and increasing access to early education. So I think that part people just assume, of course, I'm mission driven, and I absolutely am. And being a mom, and people see I have kids and I'm living my brand. But I think what isn't shared enough is the other piece of, like, actually, we're going to have huge outcomes here. And I am in it to drive a really huge outcome. I don't think there's a downside because of the industry I'm already working in. Now, of course, if I was like working in like Bitcoin and was just some kind of like grift, of course, that would be different. But I'm not running a grift. People can see that I really do care about the impact we're having. And we do a lot of work with like Head Start programs and free childcare and a lot of things that don't make people question our mission driven nature. But that might be different if we were like a fintech company or something like that.
But do you think like the outcomes of a lot of these different companies, like underlying, like obviously it's the CEO or founders, whoever is the management team, whatever, like, do you think that for them to get really big, like, for them to be like even mission driven is really important. Like it could happen that you could have just like kind of fallen into an industry. So that's kind of what happened to me is like, I started my career in computer science. I really love just big building stuff. And then I was like, hey, I moved to San Francisco. I was like, hey, there should be like an Uber for shipping. I'm like, okay, I'm going to build that. And like now I've spent the last like decade in logistics space. So like, I guess my question is like, or maybe just a comment, it's like, it seems like it is kind of like a taboo thing to say that you just want to make a shitload of money. No, well, honestly, it is, right? Like even to investors sometimes, but yeah. Then you look at and you talk to the people that have made the most amount of money and like your incentives are aligned. Like investors want to make the most amount of money as possible. But like when you're giving a pitch, you have to like kind of placate sometimes it's like, well, we're really mission driven on this. And like, we think we'll expand all this versus like, this is the market. I see the opportunity. This is how we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And like, I don't know which, like, for one, I don't know what the motivations of most people are. For two, I don't know what actual investors or even the public wants to hear. But it's just kind of like this interesting thing based on this tweet. It was like, yeah. the people that make the most amount of money for me as an investor are the ones that are driven by money, not by mission.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a balance. You don't want to invest in a founder who is only driven by money because then they might, you know, raise at a high valuation, take secondary and go peace out with some nice compensation package. If you were only driven by money, you.
But if you're truly here, I'll actually push back on that. If you're truly driven by money, you will realize that the secondary piece, if you're building a multi-billion-dollar company, that is going to be such a small percentage. So like, I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's any like startup founders that have been public in that they are just trying to build the biggest company for financial returns. Everybody's all about right. the mission, right? It's like Airbnb or Facebook or, and I kind of like question like ultimately what is that just like the PR campaign that they're putting on? What is their true motivations? And what is the best for you thinking about building? Like this whole podcast is about building venture backed outcomes,
right?
Which are going to be the outliers. Like, do you need to tell that story to employees to get them riled up and the mission and customers and all that, and also to investors? But like, is the real actual like drive for you to personally get very wealthy? And is that okay?
Yeah, I think it would be hard for an investor to invest in someone whose only drive was to get very wealthy. I don't think it has to be that you have a mission focus and you're investing out of a person, you're founding a company out of a personal passion or problem. Like you said, some founders are motivated by the challenge of the problem. It's just a very interesting and hard problem to solve. Or they learn about that there's kind of a white space and they see an opportunity that no one else sees.
Right.
Have to be the same way that I fell into Winnie, you know, solving my own problem of finding childcare. But I do think there has to be, for an investor to invest, there has to be some sort of reason that you're interested beyond just financial gain, because there are too many other and better ways to make money and make a lot of money than starting a company. In fact, I think I would argue it's one of the worst ways to make a lot of money.
Interesting. Okay.
It's, you know, one of the hardest, most risky, most companies fail. And most companies that don't fail, you don't necessarily have a big outcome. So I don't think it's the way I would choose to make a lot of money if that was my entire passion and focus. But I don't think it's a bad thing or a dirty word to say that you also want to make a lot of money.
Got it. So interesting. So What do you, so you obviously have been at Winnie for 7 years. You founded it, you're a CEO, you're venture backed. So obviously you're trying to take this company to, and also you're profitable, which is amazing, but obviously that just gives you more runway to eventually have some sort of big exit, which is like, it has to be the exit path of any venture company. What do you think, going back to your comment, what do you think is the best way to make money? You're a smart person. Do you have a technical background at all?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm a computer science major from MIT. I didn't know that.
Okay, cool.
Wow,
that's great.
Software engineer, but I basically did product and always.
I didn't know that.
Voting on the side. Yes. I mean, like, I would have just stayed at Google if I wanted to make a lot of money. Even a job like something in finance or an investor that pays very well. I mean, these jobs can pay extremely well. I would just have invested my extra income and saved. And that's the most surefire way to make a lot of money.
Well, that's the least risky, though.
Yeah.
Do you think that actually is the most surefire way to actually make money? A lot of money? Like, let's actually talk like real numbers.
My family, where it was like me and my husband, we both worked at Google and, you know, our salaries were getting up there. Yeah, that is like a great way to make a lot of money. Now we both work for Winnie and earn very little and have a ton of risk. Not a great way to make a lot of money. And these are our prime earning years. You know, and we're eating into our personal assets and savings, which is not good because there's a time factor to your money. Another, you know, good way to make a lot of money is work for these companies that are going to, you know, IPO or have exit events, I did with, you know, Twitter and also with Postmates, which got acquired by Uber.
Postmates. I made
money in both of those things. Kind of what enabled me to start a company is I had a little bit of money from those outcomes. So, you know, this has been the worst way to make money so far.
Short term.
But I, you know, have this unrealistic belief that we can have this really outsized outcome. And that's why I'm still doing it 7.5 years later, but I don't think it's, you know, the proven safe way to make money.
So again, I'm going to actually push back on this because I think that, we're both based in the Bay Area. So we have, and we also have both computer science backgrounds. So like we are in the top 0.whatever% of like earners. So we're definitely are very privileged and we have a lot of opportunities at our disposal. So let's talk about like real numbers. Like if like your goal is to make, let's call it like 10 million or $20 million in the bank, which I think is probably like, a good goal, which a lot of people would like, that would be amazing and obviously life-changing. And I think that like, even talking from finance people, that's when like you basically outside of like buying insane properties and everything, like you don't have to worry about money and you could basically do whatever you want if you have that kind of nest egg. So like, what is the absolute like best path to get there? Like we're both CS majors. I didn't work for Google or anybody as an engineer. You know, I worked for Boeing and some Canadian space companies, a little different, but assuming that we both can go the engineering route or we could go the entrepreneur route, like I think the engineering route, like when you are a senior engineer, let's call it like 750K, I don't know, including stock options, maybe at like a Google and Netflix or something like that. Would you say that that's like a year?
Let's say it's 500K.
Let's say 500K.
And so, you know, if you're a dual income household and you're each earning $500K, that's $1 million that you're earning. And if you can do that, you know, early on in your career while your expenses are, you know, not insane and you could actually put a bunch of that money away in savings, like that's, you know, a pretty incredible way to get started and grow your net worth.
Of course. So taking the other side, so say over 5 years, you're putting away, I don't know, your dual income, putting away, let's just call it 500K a year. And so you have like $5 million in the bank after a decade or something like that, versus the entrepreneurial side of things where like the first, like at least the first 5 years, you're going to eat dirt and you're not going to make anything at all. But if you would carry that on for 20 years, right? Like I think that the average age of successful companies is I think the stereotypical is like that it's the early 20s that's the person that creates these companies and they all go off and make like billions of dollars. That's actually not true. I'm pretty sure that the average age is like late 30s, even early 40s, as far as the unicorn founders when they start their companies. So you have to take a longer horizon in how long you're going to make your money. But if you stick at it for 20 years, like you got to think you're going to have like at least a 20 or $50 million outcome somewhere along the way.
I mean, those are exceedingly, exceedingly rare. So if you're factoring in
say in 20 years, say you have at least three at bats, right?
Yeah, maybe three at bats, but still like, you know, a percentage times three or, you know, trying that three times is still exceedingly low probability that you're going to hit anything big. Most outcomes of startups are either just like absolutely goes to zero. So you get nothing or let's assume you're at best saving $0 at, you know, in many cases, you're actually.
That's true. That's totally true. Yeah.
You know, eating into my savings.
Yeah.
But at best, let's say you could figure out a way to survive on ramen and you just don't, you know, burn your personal savings. You're entirely dependent on that outcome. And most of the time that outcome is either nothing or it's an acqui-hire where maybe you get like a nice like $1 million kind of signing bonus and then you have to stay at some company for 4 years and earn out. Or it's like, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you sell to private equity for $100 million, but you only own, you know, 10% of the business and there is an earnout and you're getting only 50% in cash. And like it actually starts to get quite small. So it's, you know, $5 million. And those outcomes are considered, you know, good outcomes. So I think it's just a really low probability way to make money. And anyone in it for just making money, there's so many better ways to make money. I think as an investor, I'd be wary of a founder who was just in it to make money because it, you know, they'd probably be doing one of those grifts then.
Or maybe it's like kind of like the really big risk takers, right? Like also on the other side of what you just explained, there's lots of people like, I'd say that there's many people that I know that are worth like over $100 million or $1 billion. And they've had like three tries at creating a company and their third one, it just like knocks it out of the park. And I think that like, we're also on the second time founders podcast. Yes. So like, I definitely think that there's something to that. I don't think that it's all like maybe going back to the original point, like I don't think that it's all mission driven, nor should it be, especially when you're aligning yourself with venture investors and like what, like you need to align your expectations with like your stake investors And you should be looking for those outsized outcomes, and like being what's the movie greed is good.
Right. Actually, there was someone else that tweeted, some investor that was like, you have a few million dollars left and you know your startup idea won't work. Do you take another swing or do you return the money? And like, I think this also illustrates the importance of like, just take some shots on goal.
Yeah.
If your business isn't working, start another one or pivot your business, because this math only works out if you're getting to that huge outcome. And like Winnie, a few years in, we completely pivoted our business to become a childcare marketplace. We were
right. Other yeah, things, that's my exact things point. Parents. Yes.
And
yes.
Like that just never would have made it. And so it
right,
took us
right.
too long. I regret waiting so long to just make that pivot. But that pivot is the reason we're still here.
Yeah.
And still kind of have an opportunity to get to that outsized outcome. And I think that's the same thing with second time founders.
Yeah, that's what I guess I'm trying to say is like more or less like you learn like the more. Yes. If you look at a percentage basis of startups being successful, it is extremely low. But I don't actually have any data to back this up, but I would think that the people who continue to like stay at something for a very, very long time, the chances that they're going to be successful are going to increase. So that may mean like you, that you're staying at this business for 7 years and now like you've, I don't know what year you'd consider you guys found product market fit, but it sounds like in year six or something like that, seven. That's fine. It doesn't matter. Like the thing, Sarah, it doesn't matter. Like it could be, like it, even if you are continuing to start companies, it could be in your third company in year like 12 or 13, but then like, then you just hit it out of the park. So like my counterpoint from like making that $10 to $20 million is like, there's definitely way more fucking risk as we know. But I think from a pure like making money, if you stick at, and like you truly do want to make money, which I don't think is a bad thing. And I also think that it aligns with everybody in like the ecosystem and that nobody else talks about, except for like kind of like crazy people, like the Adam Newmans of the world and all this, that they just want to make all this money. But I actually don't think it's a bad thing. And I also think that like the longer you stick at something or the more tries you have at more companies, like, yeah, you're not going to get that like $5 million over a decade if you just like were working at Google, but like the outcome that you could get $100 million over like 15 or 20 years is you have a much higher probability of doing that.
Yeah.
So it's the more risky, but like high reward kind of thing that nobody really talks about then. And that's what I just got from that tweet. It's like, looking at the founders that return the most capital, it's the ones that actually really wanted to build like a big business, which means they make more money, versus right. the ones that are like super mission driven. And also like most of the people that we see are all kind of full of shit. Like Mark Zuckerberg, like we want to connect all the people. No, he wants to be the fucking one of the most like rich, like right. and same with Elon Musk, like all yeah. of these things. It's all mission focused, but at the end of the day, they want to make a shitload of money, which hopefully they do good with it, and maybe they use that to do all those things. But I think that it's just kind of a weird thing in our industry that it's like you need to be mission focused, and that's all that's all about.
I think you want to like find a founder who does really want to make a lot of money because they haven't had that like massive outcome yet, but also isn't so. Poor,
yes.
That was part of the thesis of us founding Winnie. We were like, we're in a privileged spot. Not a lot of people have the opportunity where they can actually afford to start a company and take this kind of salary cut. We have to do this. If not us,
right.
we will. But also, you know, we haven't made it yet. So we're really hungry to, you know, have that big outcome one day.
Right. Yeah, because you both, you and your husband, like, you had the opportunity to stay at larger companies and to be making like a lot of really great money, and you chose to go and create Winnie for a reason.
So my husband is not my co-founder. He now works.
He was very much
in it from the beginning and supporting me and knew that it would mean, you know, in some ways he might have to take a step back and really be in on this bet. And he very much did that and showed up and was a stay-at-home dad for 4 years when I needed him to be. And now,
that's so awesome.
An incredible asset at Winnie. So he's literally, he's, you know, the most all into this as someone could be, wouldn't have been possible without him. But, my co-founder, Anne, was also, you know, very much of the mindset that like, we have some privilege that we could actually afford to take this risk, but definitely not too much privilege that we don't want this to be really successful one day.
Right. No, I totally get that. I have a bunch of other topics that we can go into. Or if you have some as well, Sarah, come on. You're a host now.
Yeah, I'm like,
hopefully,
trying
will
out.
Will you accept the host position right now on air?
I mean, I don't know that I think I need to start another company to do that.
No, just the rotating hosts. No, yes. there's nothing.
I need to start some side business, acquiring a professional sports team to really be a host.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of topics going around our chat. That we could talk about.
Yeah. So I looked through that, and one of them was, I think we could talk a little bit about this. There's a lot of bad behavior right now in like the VC world that is like super shitty for founders. I hope that we're like coming down on like the downslope, and then there's this like upward momentum coming in like Q4 or Q1, but in every cycle there, when companies are right now, they are the companies, especially that raise a shitload of money in 2021, they're burning a ton of cash. They're now in a position they need to raise more money. There's going to be a lot of like bad VC behavior. I don't know if you're seeing that at all. I have some specific examples that I have been sworn not to talk about. Yep. So I can't talk about that, but,
I mean, one thing that is public, like that just came out in an article from The Information, is like venture firms are selling shares in the companies they've invested in. And in some cases, venture firms actually invest in other venture firms and they're selling those stakes. So there's a pretty prominent firm, Left Lane, that there's some other VC that's an LP in that firm that's selling their stake. So that's not ever a good sign. Like if I were a founder and Left Lane was one of my investors, it's not great that someone wants to like get rid of that whole portfolio. And also as a founder, it wouldn't feel great if one of my VCs was like, actually, I want to sell my stake in Winnie so I can get some liquidity. And now you have this other person that owns 20% of Winnie that you didn't actually choose to be your investor. That can be really challenging depending on who buys that stake. And you know, whether it comes with other kinds of rights or control. So I think that's just from what I had known, that was pretty unheard of, that like an early stage VC would sell their stake in your company before you had a liquidity event. And now that's becoming increasingly common. In fact, there was even a company, Rewind, that like raised a lot on a probably very inflated valuation, in my opinion, because they're one of those AI hype companies. But they were like helping their investors sell secondary which means like everyone's kind of like in agreement, the valuation was inflated and they need to get out, which, you right. know, it can't feel good for anyone that, you know, wants to believe in the future of the company.
Yeah, I think it's tough. I think from like the founder's perspective, I think that you always, and I always have thought that like the investors, and this is where I think that like you have to, and going back to like our initial topic of like, do you have aligned incentives? I think that as much as you possibly can throughout the course of your company have aligned incentives, that's the best. Where they definitely start to diverge, especially in the traditional, you raise an A and a B and a C and a D, like your early investors are probably going to be the most aligned with you. And because like as a founder, like you can like just take this for what it's worth. Like imagine you're like, I don't think we could raise like a Series C or something like that. It's like the market's not that great. And also we have this acquisition that like, it's like we raised at like a 40 million post and this acquisition's for like $250 million or something like that. And like that would be an amazing exit for a founder, obviously. And so I think that like your seed or A investors are going to be most aligned with the actual founder. But when you start getting to like C and D, like they're like, fuck that. And they'll actually block the deal. So that would be just like an example of like misaligned incentives. Because like if you had somebody that just like did your Series D deal, or no, let's say Series C deal at 250 million or something like that, they're like, I'm not making anything, I'm gonna fucking block this deal. And like I think that you guys are going to go much bigger. And if they actually don't have the belief in the CEO anymore, or think that they can actually hire somebody else in for the CEO role, to be like, fuck this, we'll find somebody else that could do it, and all this. So I think that it's always about like aligned incentives. So I think that as a founder, what I would do is try to maintain as much as that as you possibly can. And that's going to happen in a number of different ways. And that, like what I'm seeing, and let's see if I could dance around the actual example that I'm thinking about right now. But it's around like there's like a recap scenario, which means like a lot of the investors that don't participate are going to lose their
right
preferred and then there is like a potential buyout offer, and the founders weren't going to make any money, but like the investors were, and all of this. And then it's just like, if your incentives aren't aligned, which like when you're building a company, when you first like take those meetings with the VCs, like they're going to like sell you, like if they decide, like it is the investor's choice if they want to like invest in you. Once they choose that, they're in sale mode. Up until that, the founders are in sale mode, and then they turn around and it's like, we're gonna do everything for you, we're gonna do all these things, all this stuff. But as you continue scaling your company, things change, incentives change, their LPs maybe wanting some liquidity earlier on, or they're looking to raise their next fund or something like that. So I think as a founder, you need to like, and for my first company at Ship, like I didn't understand anything. Like what the fuck is like an LP, like new fund? Why do I even care about that? And as long as you could keep the incentives aligned, with your, board, more importantly, your board than, the majority of the board, more than any individual investor, because any individual investor could have different incentives depending on maybe they're going through a liquidity crunch, or they actually do need to sell something. And maybe in this case, I don't know the underlying details of this. It's like they could have went to the founder. It's like, hey, like, we need to sell shares here. And here's what we're willing to give you or the company to be able to allow us to do that. Typically, you can't sell shares. That's typically the normal standard operating procedure. But I don't know how much, and this is the reminder, the Second Time Founders podcast, how much you actually, Sarah, pay attention to this type of like financial engineering stuff, and like the board is doing this and this board member wants this and all of these different things.
I mean, fundamentally, I think we've been really fortunate to have some amazing investors, but fundamentally, founders are placing one bet and it's in their company and that's it. Whereas investors, placing many bets, and those bets also happen in different tranches with the funds they have to raise. And so you're like fundamentally just not aligned, because even though you technically do want, you know, a big outcome for the business, you also have to think about things like raising your next fund and using liquidity in your LPs and whether that liquidity allows you to raise the next fund. So you may take a smaller outcome, sooner so you can show returns, for example, or give liquidity to LPs so you can then raise the next fund from those LPs. And so fundamentally, I think that is a challenge. And in good financial times, it's fine. Like you don't really run into this. But in these tough financial times, this is when everything kind of comes to the surface.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we're starting to see that with VCs selling their stake, also with these weird kind of raises where VCs have like way more kind of preference than, you know, the common shares. And it's just, it's all in all not great for founders.
Yeah, we're in a down market. And like, what I think, like, my advice to anybody listening, that I know that we, hopefully there's just all founders that are listening here and no investors ever listen to this, but there probably are. I think that like the only thing that you can do to really control all of these different things, like in the information article that you shared, Sarah, and also the inside info that I had on this other company, I think that, you don't have to make these hard decisions if you control your own destiny. So like what you did, and I won't disclose what we're doing, but like control your own destiny. Don't have to rely on venture capital, and then you don't have to make these tough decisions. It really doesn't, it still would matter if like you had somebody who wanted to sell shares, and there's going to be obviously, then I'm not sure if there's going to be a board change or whatever, but that most likely it would have to go through shareholder and both like board approval. But like the advice that I'd give it anybody listening would be like, just make sure your company's in good standing. Like that's what you could do. Like get more offers. Like if you have other people, say you are a 2021 vintage company that raised a shitload of money and all of this, like cut down, like this is obviously like we're 2 years past this, but like, so it's not great advice probably now, but like cut down your team,
right?
Get fucking profitable, like make it a business that people that in like sane times actually want to invest in or get profitable. And that's what you could do to take back control of your company. Outside of that, and I know I talked to lots of founders that complain about the VC landscape and it's like so tough and all this shit. And it's like, you signed up for this.
Right.
Like you did. We both signed up. We knew the venture landscape was like, and we know that the ups and downs and everything that can happen. And I would say that I'll speak in mine and Sarah, what you shared as well, our behalfs, is like we've taken back control of our own destiny, and that's not what a lot of other founders are doing, and they're just sitting there and complaining and be like, wow, like this VC is fucking me over and all this stuff. And it's like, you had a decision 2 years ago when you had all this cash and you decided to keep the team super like bloated and burn all this money because you wanted to keep growth rates up. And that's obviously, I'm generalizing, and I'm sure there's edge cases to that. But I think that my advice would just be like, take the decision points out of VC's hands, put it in your hands, and build the best business you can.
Another kind of small fix is to have an independent board director. We actually used to have one, and he did his term and has rolled off to move on to bigger and better things. But it was incredible because the board, whether they're a VC or not, they're supposed to act in the best interest of the company when they're wearing that board director hat. But it's sometimes hard to know if the VC members of your board are always acting in the best interest of the company or in terms of their investment or their other, you know, concerns. Great they have point. To balance. Whereas an independent, you always know, like assuming you make a good independent board director hire.
And they were not referred by the VC,
by the VCs, and they
which
are,
is a very,
you know,
thing.
Compensated with equity in the business. That is generally like someone that should be always thinking in the best interest of the company and what makes the most valuable company. So that was always really helpful for us because that kind of was that quote independent
journey
that wasn't just like the founders deserve this, the VCs deserve this, but could just, you know, sometimes agreed with us, sometimes didn't, but was always sort of acting in a very neutral manner. And it was really helpful to have that perspective. And, you know, I really miss that. So, you know, we're definitely, if anyone wants to be an independent board director, we are talking to folks and looking. It's a great experience. And I think, you know, can learn a lot, especially if you're interested in becoming a founder or you were a founder and you don't necessarily aren't ready to start your next company. But it's really helpful to have that voice in the room kind of just acting in the best interest of the business.
Yeah. And also, I would just add on, like, you almost have to think that even though that, like, together, like, investors or your employees or your co-founders or everybody else, like, you start this thing, right? And like you're together building it in the best of times, it seems like you're all like being one cohesive unit. But I think that you need to realize that every single person has their individual interests at heart. And that could be like we're talking about like venture investors specifically right now. And you have to realize that. And I think that over my career, and that's also why I think that, like, going back to like our earlier point, like I definitely would roll the dice on like being a 30-year entrepreneur versus like going and working at Google, even if the chances that I would make a lot more money at Google are even they definitely would not hire me because I'm not that good of an engineer. But I think that you just learn so much. Like what I've learned over the past decade, and this is the entire reason that we started this podcast, is that we want to share these learnings, but you just get so much better. Like I never, like if I had a Series D company and our Series A investor would be like, hey, and actually a great example, USV actually does this public. This is a venture firm out of New York. They actually will liquidate, sell their stock to other companies, even prior to an IPO. Oh. And this is like a known kind of thing. And like, if I didn't really know this type of stuff and like, what does liquidity mean? And like, what is like raising a new fund? And like, what is de-risking that asset class and like all this stuff. No, I would be like, you're on my board, you're selling half your shares. I'd be like, fuck you. I'm like, you're the worst person ever. But like, I think understanding all of this stuff really, like, it makes you a better CEO, founder, all of that. And then also, if you're extremely clever, you could gamify a lot of the stuff as well. Like we want to have advice on the downside, but also the upside. Like if you're probably looking to sell your company and you have raised like a Series C or a Series D, like go to your Series Seed and Series A investor and like make sure that you've got them all bought into this opportunity before you even bring it to the board. So it's like, it's not even like a question. It's like, this is the best thing for the company. And then talk with them to be like, well, if we don't sell here, like here's all the risks and all these things. And so not only do you come with actual like the voting power, but also you come with like a cohesive message that you know those people are going to be on their side because they're going to be making 5 to 10x on the seed investors will make even more, but like the Series A investors will make 5 or 10x. And then you go to the C and D investors and be like, this is what we actually want to do, even if you have to get their vote. And then it's like, this is the cohesive message that we have that actually makes sense. And you make them feel like this is the only actual like way to get things done. I think that some things that have came out publicly would be, I don't know, I don't know why I always think of Uber, but like it was like, it's a coordinated effort for anything. So like I remember reading all of the Uber's in trouble. There was the Travis incident with the him talking back to one of their Uber drivers. There was reported, it was basically, and there was sexual assault allegations on behalf of a number of senior employees and all this stuff. And I just like remember seeing all of the articles, and I really read that really carefully. And like, if you look at it, it's like a coordinated effort by eventually the entire board to push Travis out. And what you can do, like, we're for founders, so we're not for investors. We're not advocating this and for investors looking to push founders out or anything like that. But you as a founder, you can do the same thing. Like, you need to get your posse and crew. You need to make sure that as, like, early on, as I mentioned, everything is like, we're going to take over the world and all this. But, like, when times get rough or when there's some trouble or whatever, like, you need to have your people on the board or even supportive of you on the board. So like your like director or VP of engineering, and it's like they're behind you and all that stuff. I don't know. I'd never thought about this before in my last company. And I can't go into specifics, but I definitely would have benefited a lot more from doing this. So hopefully this is like learning for people. I don't know what you would have to say.
Yeah, I mean, there's just you had asked on a earlier episode about, you know, should founders get more equity once they're fully vested in the company? And my answer was yes. Like, investors should do everything they need to do to keep the founders, assuming they are still the best people to run the business. And I think, you know, there was just this very public example at Flexport where, you know, they brought in this experienced hire, they got rid of the founder. And then a year later, like the business is in shambles and trying to bring the founder back again, and probably at great expense because of the, you know, exit package they had to give to this guy.
Yeah, he probably got like Dave Clark from Amazon. Let's be real. He probably got like $50 million to get out of the business, at least.
Right. So I just think, you know, there is in a, you know, we're not talking about a public company, but in a early stage business before there's you know, before it's going public, like time and time again, it has been shown that when you try to bring in the quote experienced hires, there's, you know, it's not the same as having a founder. And if you can keep the founders motivated and just as excited about continuing to build the business, and they're still really great founders, like that, there's no value you can put on that. That's worth the entire company. And I just feel like that isn't well understood. And you can also see it in all these, like, there's all these cases of female founders getting ousted because there was some takedown in the press.
Yeah, I hate
all
that shit.
Businesses have gone under when you removed that, like, look at The Wing and Audrey Gelman, and, you know, that whole business went under without her because she was business. It was her.
Well, there is probably like, what, 3 or 4 other examples of that as well.
Yeah.
And it's like the press takedown of the female founder for whatever reason, like, and you probably have a better read on this, why the press wants to take down female founders. But
yeah,
I would even put it like a like from my perspective is like the founders are like the lifeblood of the company.
Right.
And like, and you should be, we're not preaching to investors here because no investors listen to this, but as a founder, these are the tactics that you can like create early on so you don't get taken down by your board, right? Like in your case in The Wing, like I don't know what the board dynamics were. What are some other female founders being taken down?
I mean, the Away Luggage.
Away, great that's example.
Still around, yeah. But like it's not having the same growth that it once had.
A great example as far as like there was like some like customer support backlash and like the founder was like really about like working hard and all this stuff and for whatever reason and I'm not going to get into press because I definitely don't know anything what I'm talking about, but like that was like super unfair. But if they had like a really strong board that backed them up, it's like, no, we don't give a fuck, like you're running this company, then they wouldn't have to resign and do all these crazy things and all that stuff. So I think that, and we're running up on time here. I think that I would say that, me personally, in my first company, I didn't totally understand board dynamics and like how you assemble board, how you manage a board, how you do all these things, and also the investors you take and all that stuff. But it really does matter when the times really do get tough. And so make sure that you really build those relationships and you also understand everybody's incentives, where they are in their career, where they are in their fun cycle, excuse me, all these different things, because that will play a massive part. It does not come down to voting, like I vote for this thing. It's all, everything is all before the board meeting and all before that big decision. It's like, should we take on more capital? Like the actual example that I can bring up is like, they had a capital infusion and literally the board like struck that down and the company's going to go to like die now, which is like crazy to me. So it's all before the board. And so I would really like, if I was a first time founder listening to this, like I would take that to really heart understanding the incentives, making sure you have the same incentives. And even also, and to the initial tweet, like we're all in this to make money. Like investors need to make money. You want to make money as a founder as well. I hope investors want the founders to make money as well, which is kind of a wild thing. I don't know, Sarah, any closing thoughts, like any you've learned over the last like 7 years?
I think you're completely right. It's a lot of managing relationships, managing the board, keeping everyone aligned and focused on the big picture to, you know, have a huge outcome one day. And, you know, it really doesn't stop when you close the round. It continues.
No,
so it's important to remember that as a founder and a CEO, that that's just going to be part of your job and a really important part of the job for kind of the future success of the company.
Cool. Well, thanks, Sarah. I think more people are going to be joining us next time. Julian was supposed to join, but apparently his computer crashed. I don't know if I believe it or not, but we'll
tough
let it
to
stand
be a with, founder with that. Without a computer.
Yeah, what is he doing all day? Who knows? Anyways, thanks everybody for listening. Until next time, see ya.
Bye.
Bye.